Dr. Charlie Bamforth joins me this week to discuss DMS in beer. This is Beersmith Podcast number 296.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit Beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 296, and it's mid-January 2024. Dr. Charlie Bamforth joins me this week to discuss DMS in beer. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They invite you to join their upcoming brewery workshop, March 24th to 27th in Austin, Texas. This one-of-a-kind event brings together professional brewers to help you start or grow your own craft brewery. To learn more, please visit breweryworkshop.com. Again, that's breweryworkshop.com. And also The Barrel Mill, creator of the Infusion Spiral, used to add flavor and aroma to wine, spirits, and beer. Their unique spiral cut design creates unrivaled surface area in a small package, allowing fast extraction of the toasted oak's aroma and flavor compounds. Looking for woods other than oak? Try their exotic woods, offering spirals made from Amberana, American and French oak, aspen, Spanish cedar, cypress, sugar maple, and more. For more information, go to infusionspiral.com. Again, that's infusionspiral.com. And Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith Brewing Software. Beersmith for the Web lets you design great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with access to the same full suite of recipe building tools as our desktop version. Try Beersmith Web today by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder to click that like and subscribe button on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're on. Clicking those buttons is a great way to support the show. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, my guest is Dr. Charlie Bamforth, Professor Emeritus of Malting and Brewing Science at the University of California at Davis. Charlie specializes in the study of wholesomeness in beer, including beer perception, polyphenols, foam stability, oxidation, and flavor stability. Charlie, it's always a pleasure to have you on. How are you today?
I'm good. Nice to be with you again. It's been a number of years now, yeah.
Are you back in California now? I know you were traveling a bit.
Yeah, I was in Kalamazoo last week. I managed to escape the snow, but I loved it. Great cities, Kalamazoo. But yeah, you know, I'm back in California. Actually, I'm in Chico today, up at the brewery. I've just signed on for my fifth year advising Sierra Nevada.
Awesome!
Which I'm delighted about. And yeah. A second edition of Scientific Principles of Malting and Brewing. Now, we just brought that out. I've been joined by my successor at UC Davis, Glenn Fox. So it's Bamforth and Fox on that one. And the fourth edition of Beer: Tap into the Art and Science of Brewing. First edition was just before I came to Davis, so that was published in 1998. So this is the fourth edition, 26 years later. So,
well, congratulations. And where can people find the new edition?
That one is at Oxford University Press, but of course it's available on Amazon or your favorite place for buying books. I hope it's on the shelves of Barnes & Noble by now. and the scientific principles one, that's best to get it the American Society of Brewing Chemists, who are the publishers of that one.
That's awesome. What else have you been up to the last year? You said you're still working at Sierra Nevada, obviously.
Yeah, and very much enjoying that. They still ask me to go speak in interesting places, and my wife usually comes and joins me. So in the last year, we were down in speaking in Santa Fe in Argentina, just north of Buenos Aires, and then we were over in Quebec City. And as I say, I was in Kalamazoo last week, and wonderful meeting of the Michigan brewers. And then I'll be over in New Orleans in March, I think it is, and Milan in in June. We're planning a sort of bit of a lecture tour in the British Isles and in Milan and possibly also in the Netherlands.
That sounds awesome. So you're doing a little bit of traveling in your retirement, huh? Your semi-retirement, I should call it.
Yeah. I'm 71 now, so I'm not sure how much longer this is going to carry on. I know I only look about 45, something like that, but you know, that's a joke. I've still got a bit of energy left, so I'm not quite sure how many more years all this will carry on, but I'm not fully retired yet.
Well, certainly enjoy it. You know, it's awesome that you're still so active and still doing great things for the brewing community.
Well, you know, I wouldn't do it if I didn't enjoy it, and so it's great. It's very nice.
Well, the topic you picked today was dimethyl sulfide, or DMS, as we call it. We talked a little bit about this briefly way back on episode 121, when we were talking about boiling. But what is DMS, and why is it so important for beer brewers?
Yeah, DMS, as you say, dimethyl sulfide. And really, people started first studying DMS in the context of beer back in the late 60s and the early 70s. And I jokingly say this is when the English finally discovered lager. You know, everybody else had discovered it many years before that, but the English discovered it then. And it seems like the North American craft brewing industry have now discovered it in 2024. When the English got their brains around lager, they were curious about what it was about the German Helles type beer, Pilsners, the lighter German lagers. What was it that they associated with this lager character? Mm-hmm. And what they identified was DMS. So these German beers had very significant levels of DMS. Now, if you talk to a German brewer, they'll say, yeah, it's a well-known flavor defect. And so there's the Germans thinking they should be getting rid of it. And the English decided that's what they need to get in. so it really, that's the science trying to understand where the DMS came from and how you could control it. That's where it all started. And so it really is one of these flavor molecules that, you know, has a divergence of opinion about it. You know, there's the Germans, got a lot of it, but they consider it a defect. There's people like the Aussies with the Fosters, they hate it. So Fosters has got, you know, they strive for as little DMS as possible. Mm-hmm. And the biggest selling brand of beer in the British Isles, which is Carling Black Label, and I wrote the control document myself and a guy called Roy Parsons back in the 80s for how to control the DMS level at a detectable level, but not too much. Now, the flavor threshold of DMS is usually considered to be about 30 micrograms per liter, 30 parts per billion. So something like Foster's is down around 20. But Carling Black Label, I can tell you what the specification is, and it's 50 parts per billion, plus or minus 10. Hmm. So enough to be detected, but not so much that it gave almost a blackcurrant-like flavor. And there are, of course, some famous lagers that have got even more than that. The most famous, of course, is Roland Rock Lager, which has got a DMS level in the low hundreds. Wow. Very, very high level DMS. And if it didn't have that level of DMS, it wouldn't be a Rolling Rock. And if Carling Black Label didn't have 50 ppb, it wouldn't be Carling. And if Foster's had more than 20, 30, it wouldn't be Foster's. So you can't really define it as an off flavor. It's just one of these flavors that you should be controlling to the desired level.
Hmm. Yeah, I know it is often considered an off flavor, at least on many of the judging sheets, but what does it taste like and what does it smell like in a beer?
Well, it smells of, the classic flavor descriptor is sweet corn or canned corn. So that is the, if you read the flavor textbooks and so on, they'll say, well, it's canned corn. But DMS is associated with many flavor of many things. If you go to the ocean and inhale, what you can smell is DMS, because seaweed produces a lot of DMS. So that's the sort of marine aroma. I always think if I eat scallops, they smell very much of DMS. Tomato ketchup has some DMS character as well. So the list goes on. So it depends on the level, but the classic descriptor is canned corn. But it can manifest in different ways. DMS is a very important molecule in nature, but there's a lot of it produced. And the best place to smell it is by the ocean. So if you're having a Rolling Rock lager at the seaside, then you get a lot of DMS.
You get a double dose there, huh?
Yeah, you do.
Well, what are the two origins of DMS? You mentioned in the paper you sent me there was two at least.
Yeah. The one that most people think about is an amino acid derivative. It's called S-methylmethionine, SMM. So there's an amino acid called methionine, which is a sulfur-containing amino acid. But SMM has got an extra methyl group, a CH3 group attached to it. And it's a fairly unstable molecule. It's actually produced in the grain, in barley during malting. It's produced in the embryo, and so as you germinate and sprout the grain, you produce more of this SMM. But it is sensitive to heat, and when the malt is kilned, then the SMM starts to break down and releases DMS, and that DMS is flushed away with the flue gases on the kiln. So basically, the more you germinate, the longer you sprout for, the more SMM you're going to produce. But the more intensely you kiln, the less of this SMM survives into the malt. So that is why something like a Pilsner malt or a pale lager malt contains rather more of this DMS precursor than something like a pale ale malt or a more heavily kilned malt. So this is one of the main reasons why the pale lager beers do historically tend to have a higher level of DMS associated with them, because they've got more being brought into the brewery. Mm. If you look at a malt specification, often the letters on there are DMSP for DMS precursor. It really annoys me that. Because because there are two precursors, but the main reason is the one they're talking about here is actually S-methylmethionine, which is SMM. So mm-hmm. if it's SMM, call it SMM. Don't call it DMSP. So you're much more likely to get a specification of this on a lager malt specification, a pale lager malt specification, than certainly unlikely to find it on a pale ale malt specification. Now the second precursor is DMSO, dimethyl sulfoxide. And it was actually myself and a guy called Brian Annis back in England at the Brewing Research Foundation back in the late 1970s, 1979, the paper was published, that we showed that a malt contained DMSO and that it's this molecule which is converted to DMS by yeast. So SMM gives DMS by heat breakdown, but DMSO is converted into DMS by yeast metabolism. When we first discovered that, our boss, a guy called John Hudson, said, "We can't publish this. We can't tell people this." I say, "Why not?" "Well, DMSO, it's a chemical solvent. You get it in chemistry laboratories." I said, "I know that, but it's in the malt." and that's what is being converted. I mean, not huge levels, but enough to be converted into DMS by yeast. Now, the DMSO is produced from the SMM during kilning, particularly at the higher curing temperatures. So when you're drying the malt, the temperature is progressively raised. And, of course, as I've said already, some of this SMM is broken down to give DMS. And at the higher temperatures, some of that DMS is converted into DMSO. So there are two precursors. One, which will give you DMS by breakdown with heat in the brewery, the brew house. But the other one is the one that is converted by the yeast into DMS, and that other one is dimethyl sulfoxide, DMSO.
So DMSO, is it more prevalent in a darker malt then? You already said that SMM is more prevalent in a lighter malt, obviously.
It is. It is. So the more heavily cured the malt, the more of the DMSO there is. Good friend of mine who was a predecessor of mine at the Brewing Research Foundation, and also went later when I was the quality manager at Bass Preston Brook, he had been the QA manager before me, excellent guy called Harry White. And it was Harry that first said that there are two precursors in malt. And he didn't call them SMM and DMSO because he didn't actually know what they were. He called them HADMS, which was heat alkali released DMS. So that was SMM. They heated it in an alkaline solution, particularly, you release DMS. And then the second one he said was active HADMS. Active for the fact that it could be metabolized by yeast. He didn't know what had happened, but what he did show was you needed to have a curing temperature on the malt in excess of 70 degrees Celsius. And if you had higher than 70 degrees Celsius, then you made more of this DMSO. So you're absolutely right, Brad. The higher curing temperatures will give you more DMSO. Now, in case I forget to mention this later on, let me also say that when you're doing this intense curing, you're also producing another sulfoxide, and that is called methionine sulfoxide. So this is produced from the amino acid methionine by reacting with oxygen. And the enzyme in the yeast that I identified, it will handle... uses both DMSO and methionine sulfoxide. So it actually, the higher the curing temperature, the more you're producing both of these molecules. And it's the methionine sulfoxide, which the enzyme will use preferentially. So just like I said earlier on, so even if you've got malt that's kiln at a lower curing temperature, say 70 degrees Celsius, it is going to give you more DMS production from the yeast than will one at a higher temperature, because at the higher temperature of kilning, the methionine sulfoxide is going to be produced more, and it's going to get in the way.
Interesting. Can you walk us through the chemical chain that leads from barley to malt through the SMM side and eventually produces DMS?
Yeah. So... as I say, if you look at raw barley, there is no precursor in there, no SMM. Mm-hmm. So it is produced in the embryo during germination. So the longer you germinate for, or the more vigorously you germinate, the more SMM you're going to produce. And also, the higher the protein content of the barley, the more SMM you're going to produce. So if you've got a higher nitrogen content, protein content in the grain, it will give you more SMM than a lower protein malt. If you're going to use process aids like gibberellic acid, then that is going to boost the production of SMM. If, however, you find ways of restricting rootlet growth and lowering the amount of rootlet growth, then you'll get less or embryo growth, you're going to get less SMM developed. Then, of course, you've got the kilning. Oh, and by the way, the vigor of the barley matters as well. So if you've got, you might have a barley that's newly germinated. It's not dormant, it's alive. But if you then store that barley for a few months, say, and then you malt it, it's got more vigor, it's got more energy, and it will produce more of the SMM. So on the kiln, as I say, as you heat on the kiln, you break down the SMM, most of the DMS is going to be washed away, flooded away. But at the higher temperatures, as I said, you are going to also produce some DMSO. So in the malt house, those are the key factors which take place.
Can you summarize on the barley selection side? What can you do if I'm looking for a barley maybe to make a very pale beer and want to reduce DMS? Is there a particular type of barley I want to look for?
No, I wouldn't look for the. I wouldn't do that on a barley selection basis. To the best of all everything I've ever studied,
or malt selection, perhaps.
Yeah, malt. And so I think the paler the malt and the more well modified the malt, you are going to have a higher level of SMM, DMS precursor, than you will with a somewhat darker malt or a less well modified malt. And in terms, like I say, in terms of the yeast source, the DMSO, then again, the lower the curing temperature, the less of the yeast derived DMS you're going to get.
Well, we often talk about using a long rolling boil to reduce DMS. How does this help?
Yeah, so as I say, if you've got heating taking place in the brew house, which you do, then you're going to get conversion of the SMM into DMS. And the most significant stage is the boil itself. Another friend of mine, Chris Dickinson, who was with the Allied Brewers. He was across the wall. I was Bass in Burton, and he was Allied Breweries next door. We were good friends, but we didn't talk. That's a joke. But he did a lot of good work on the kinetics, the breakdown of the SMM. And what he showed, Brad, was that if you boil at 100 degrees Celsius, mm-hmm. and as you know, I never use the F word, so.
Yep.
I think that's 212 Fahrenheit. But anyway, if you boil at that temperature, then and you've got a pH of the wort of 5.5, then after the half-life of the SMM is 38 minutes. So what that means is after 38 minutes, half of that SMM is broken down into DMS. Mm-hmm. Now, so you produce DMS, but if it's a vigorous rolling boil with a lot of turbulence, a lot of agitation, then that DMS is driven off. It's driven off and does not linger. So if you don't want DMS in your beer, you need that malt with the lowest possible liquid, but you've got to boil vigorously long enough to effect this this conversion, and you've got to have this agitation, this turbulence. Now, what Chris showed also is if you drop the pH, the half-life was, so if you raise the pH, I've got the wrong way around, that should have been 5.2. So 38 minutes of 5.2. If you were at 5.5, then it was only 32 minutes. So the pH matters as well. So you get more of the breakdown at the higher pHs. So a half-life of 32 minutes, pH 5.5. But 38 minutes at pH 5.2. So the pH matters, how much SMM you've got there, but the vigor and the turbulence of the boil. So a long turbulent boil is what you should have if you want to minimize the level mm-hmm. of SMM and perhaps the slightly higher pH. Now, what Chris also showed was that if you drop the temperature by 6 degrees Celsius, the half-life doubles. So if you're at 94 degrees Celsius, then at pH 5.2, the half-life is 76 minutes.
Wow.
And at 88 degrees Celsius, the half-life is 152 minutes and so on. So what this tells you straight away, first of all, is that during mashing, infusion mashing, for example, you're not going to get much, if any, breakdown of SMM into DMS. It's not happening in sweet wort production. Is happening in the boil. And the second thing it tells you is depends what temperature you're boiling at. And of course that depends on the altitude. Mm-hmm. So if you're in Davis, California, which is essentially sea level, then it's boiling at 100 degrees Celsius. But if you're a mile high,
yeah, in Colorado,
no names, no pack drill, but that company owns the Carling Black Label brand these days. But anyway, the wort is boiling at a much lower temperature, maybe 94, 95 degrees Celsius. So that changes all of the dynamic, all the rate of conversion. And what it means, if you're trying to make the same beer and have the same control at different breweries at different altitudes, you've got to account for that.
Wow.
And so if you don't want DMS, then you know, the things that I've talked about, a vigorous boil. Now, if you do want DMS, it's a very different story. So, you know, I'm prepared to tell you about Carling White Label because, you know, Bass sold the breweries to Interbrew and to Coors. So, but Carling Black Label specified the level of the SMM in the malt. We had a 1 hour vigorous boil, but then the next important stage is the hot work receiver, the whirlpool. Mm-hmm. And we had a residence time in the whirlpool of 1 hour. 1 hour in that whirlpool.
Sounds quite long.
It is. Normally it's, you know, 10, 15 minutes, something like that. Whatever you do, you've got to keep it constant if you want to control the SMM or the DMS.
Sure.
And of course, the reason we did this was we wanted a finite level of DMS. So we control the length of the boil to deliver a given concentration of SMM into the whirlpool. And then in that whirlpool, over the 1 hour, and of course, remember, it's insulated, so the temperature's right up there, still very hot. You progressively converting SMM, any SMM that survived the boiling, you're converting it into DMS. And it's very gentle, swirling around, so there's no turbulence. So the DMS is not going anywhere. It's staying in the wort.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want a significant level of DMS in the beer, if you're making something like Rolling Rock, you know, a very pale, gently dried malt, not too long a wort a boil, but a long whirlpool residence, for example, an hour, to generate a lot of DMS going into the fermenter.
Wow. So I have to ask, is there anything else you can do to reduce the DMS during the brew itself, during the brewing process, other than the whirlpool and the boil?
In the brew house, those are the major factors.
Okay.
The one other thing you can do is if you are the old Anheuser-Busch company. I don't know what they do now, but in the production of Budweiser, historically, there has been another vessel after whirlpool. That is the wort stripper. So in the wort stripper, there's a stream of gas that was used, was driven through wort to purge off any DMS that was surviving, to deliberately drive it off. Now, of course, in modern latter-day brew houses, there's a lot of attention to vapor stripping systems as an alternative to conserve energy. So less heat input, and replacing the sort of the turbulence, replacing that with a vapor stream. There's nothing new about it. Anheuser-Busch have been doing that for decades.
So what kind of gas do they run through it to do that? It's kind of interesting.
Well, my understanding is, I'm not sure it is now, but my understanding was it was air. Oh. And that's, you know, that's the ironic thing, because I would defy anybody to say that, you know, over the years, I would defy people to say that one of the freshest beers is definitely Budweiser. And that yet there they were, having a fairly large potential input of air into the product. But you've got to remember, and we're touching on a different topic now, you've got to remember this is before fermentation. And yeast is great at mopping up
oxygen,
Yeah, all of those things. So,
but are there any risk? Are they running hot at that point? Are there risk of hot sideration or no?
Well, my understanding is that it's still pretty hot. So, but I'm not. Although I was the Anheuser-Busch Endow professor, I certainly wasn't privy to their inside secrets.
Like you said, they may have changed the process by now for other reasons.
They may well have.
Well, let's go into the second one, which is obviously DMS production by yeast from DMSO.
Yep.
Can you walk us through that chemically, and then perhaps anything you can do to fix it?
Yeah, it's interesting. I say it was Brian Annis and myself that first came up with this back in 79. And people didn't believe us. They just didn't believe us. There was a strong school of thought that yeast does not make DMS, and that's just not right. That's wrong. And people, they said to me, Charlie, look at all the DMS that's present at the start in the wort going into the fermenter, and look at how much DMS is in the finished beer. And there's a lot less DMS at the end of fermentation than the start. So how can you be stupid enough to say that yeast makes DMS? And I said, because if you analyze the CO2 coming off a fermenter, the number one contaminant is DMS. There's a hell of a lot more. And indeed, yes, with Carling Black Label, we set the target level of DMS at the start at a certain level, knowing that we were going to have a lower level at the end. But the level of DMS that you've got at the end is the balance between how much is lost and how much new DMS is being produced from DMSO by the yeast. And it is a balance. And you can't really tell but by simply measuring the DMS. So I draw your attention to a study that was done by Interbrew, the forerunner of InBev, Anheuser-Busch InBev, in Belgium a number of years ago. And what they did on an experimental scale was they did fermentations with labeled DMSO. In other words, DMSO that had got a label on it. Mm-hmm. And now people didn't consume the beer, but they knew what proportion of the DMS at the end in the beer came from SMM and what proportion came from DMSO. And what they found was 80%, 8 out of every 10 DMS molecules had the label. So they'd actually come from DMSO by yeast metabolism. Yeah, yeah.
I would have guessed the opposite, but...
No, it's very significant. It's very significant. Now, it depends. You know, when I first joined Bass in 1983, my boss, Tony Portno, said, Charlie, welcome to Bass. Our yeast does not make DMS. which I showed quietly without pointing
out. I think all yeast makes DMS, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It all makes it because it's got this enzyme, this sulfoxide reductase, which does the job. But I do know the reason why, and this is a little bit of a segue, that in the day at Bass, we made our own malt. For example, in the big Shobnal maltings, malt house in Burton-on-Trent. And what we used to have was the simplest kilning regime I've ever encountered. The way we used to dry the malt, Carling Label, was with an air on temperature of 65 degrees Celsius and an air off temperature and at the start of the process, and the same temperature all the way through 24 hours. We simply dried the malt at a constant 65 degrees Celsius for 24 hours. Mm-hmm. So if you recall what I said a few minutes ago, it's only when you go above 70 degrees Celsius, you produce much DMSO.
Right.
So Tony Portner was probably quite right. You know, it wasn't a big thing for Carling Black Label. But if any malt is kilned over 70 degrees Celsius, it will have some DMSO. So what happens is that the yeast has got in it an enzyme which will convert sulfoxides like DMSO, dimethyl sulfoxide, and methionine sulfoxide to the non-oxidized version. They'll reduce it. So it's called sulfoxide reductase. And it draws on the what we call the reducing power, the hydrogen, from the central pool. So what we showed, Ryan and I showed, was various factors influence the extent to which the yeast makes DMS. Yeast strain has got some effect, but not a huge effect. And in fact, we did most of our experiments with an ale yeast, not actually with a lager yeast. But the number one thing that we showed was important was the temperature. So the lower the temperature of the fermentation, the more yeast made DMS. So if you fermented at something like 6 or 8 degrees Celsius, classic sort of Germanic fermentation temperature, you're going to produce a lot more DMS than if you ferment relatively warm at something like 15 degrees Celsius. So the lower the fermentation temperature, more DMS. We also showed that the level of free amino nitrogen, FAN, was very important. The more FAN, more assimilable nitrogen, the lower the DMS. And the explanation for this is if the yeast has got a lot of nitrogen, it's got a lot of nutrition, then that's going to mean more yeast growth. And to get more yeast growth, it needs more of that, what we call reducing power, more of the hydrogen, if you like. And it siphons it away. So there's less of it available for sulfoxide reduction. But if you are limited with nitrogen, and if the yeast is hurting and it's growth limited, then it tends to produce more DMS because it's not siphoning the hydrogen, the electrons, the reducing power in the direction of yeast growth. So basically, if you, for this reason, a lower fermentation temperature is, all things being equal, going to give you a lot more DMS, but also the DMS will start to be produced rather more late on, towards the end of the fermentation to a greater extent. And dare I say it, because as you know and other people know, I've got a bit of a bee in my bonnet about prolonged maturation, you are going to tend to produce more DMS the longer you keep the yeast in contact with the beer.
So you said a couple interesting things here. One of them is that you, as you lower the temperature, obviously you get more more of this DMS. More DMS produced, which is kind of the opposite of most other off flavors, right? You think about raising the yeast temperature produces more more other off flavors, correct?
Yeah, correct. It's peculiar. I'm not sure we've ever totally explained why. But it's a fact. We showed this repeatedly, that as you drop the fermentation temperature, it produces more DMS. And the other thing I'd just toss into the debate is, like something like the esters, the higher the gravity, so the stronger the wort, then you will tend to produce disproportionately more DMS as well.
So a stronger beer also is going to have more DMS in it. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Now the other thing you mentioned, the low free or increasing the free nitrogen. Is there anything that can be done to increase the free nitrogen to reduce the DMS?
The second method. It's not an area that I would focus on, quite honestly, yeah. Brad. Because when you start messing around with the FAN, you are going to affect a lot of other things as well. Mm-hmm. So you're going to be affecting esters. You're going to be affecting the stability of the product as well. Higher levels of FAN residual post fermentation are not good for either micro stability or flavor stability. So that's not the way I've always viewed it is that I identify when you make your first, say you're making a new lager beer, and you've got a certain set of conditions, and that set of conditions, including fermentation conditions, you say that's what I like. That is that's the product I want. Then the way to control the yeast pathway is to say, okay, we've got to keep the same conditions every time, whether it including the temperature, the FAN, all of those things, gravity, and so on. People say, well, should we be specifying the DMSO level in the malt? And I say, no, it's pointless. Because despite the fact I've said how important the yeast can be, and is often, it's not converting in proportion to the amount of DMSO there. So the yeast is probably only going to convert about 10-20% of the DMSO. So you've still got most of that DMSO left behind afterwards. So there's no point in specifying the level of DMSO. The way you control the yeast pathway is to control all the variables and let the DMS look after itself. So you specify the malt and how it's produced, you specify which fermenter, because if you've got the more capacity for the to be stripping of volatiles, the sort of shallow fermenters are going to get more DMS loss than you will in a deep sort of conical. So you've got to control which fermenter. You control obviously the yeast strain, you control the FAN level, you control the temperature. pH has got a somewhat of an effect, it's not enormous. So the way to control the DMS level is know exactly how much you want, what it should be for to deliver the character you want, but then to maintain the cold side conditions consistently every time.
And you mentioned yeast selection. Do different yeast strains produce different amounts of DMS?
Yeah, they can, but and this is an area, although we've looked at a bunch of different yeast strains early on, we did that. As I say, we didn't, for example, we didn't see any simple division between Saccharomyces cerevisiae and Saccharomyces pasteurianus. We didn't see that. Mm-hmm. So yes, different yeasts, depending on how much of this sulfoxide reductase they've got in them. But I would suggest that it's the fermentation conditions that are going to be more important than the yeast strain for DMS production.
So going into a new lager, would I want to shoot for a higher fermentation temperature, I guess? And then what else?
Well, it depends what you want.
Yeah.
And if you want,
if I want low DMS.
If you want low DMS, then yeah, mm-hmm. I would belt it through, you know, a higher fermentation temperature. I'd use a very lightly dried malt so I wouldn't have any DMSO. But of course, because I've got a lightly dried malt, I'm going to have a higher level of SMM. So those
catch
circumstances.
22.
Well, yeah. Do you know, Brad, I get a notification every month about, you know, who downloads my papers. And by far and away, the most heavily downloaded paper is the one I sent to you about DMS control.
Yeah, so, yeah, it's interesting.
And it's, you know, it's a beautiful molecule. And when I teach, it's a beautiful way to illustrate all of the implications of everything from raw material selection right the way through to the finished product. Because the grain itself, the nitrogen content, the way you malt it, all of those things, the brew house conditions, fermentation conditions, all of those things influence the level of DMS you're going to get. So I find it's a fascinating an explanation. And there's actually an added complication as well. So I'll segue into, if it's okay with you, I'll segue into a story. So yeah. At Bass in the day, we had 13 breweries back in Bass in the mid-80s. And as I said, myself and Roy Parsons, we wrote the document, How to Control the DMS. And of course, we were based in the research department in Burton-on-Trent, the mothership. Now, of course, one of our breweries is up in Glasgow. They didn't call the beer up the Carling Black Label. It was Tennent's Lager. But the Tennent's was supposed to match the Carling Black Label in every way. So my boss, Portno, called me in and he said, Glasgow are running at 30 parts per billion. You know, because you wrote the document, the specification is 50. Go up there and sort them out. So I went to Glasgow. Of course, I'm English. So they said, what are you doing here, wee man? I said, I'm here to point out the error of your ways in that your DMS is far too low. It's only 30. It should be 50. And they said, you listen to me. We've been brewing lager in Glasgow for hundreds of years. You're ale brewers. You know nothing. 30 in Glasgow is the same as 50 in England. So why don't you go home and find out why that is? So I went home, and Roy Parsons did some experiments correlating the level of DMS in different batches with the perceived DMS, and he got lousy correlation. So you could have batches with fairly significant levels of DMS, but the correlation with perceived DMS was not very good. But for some reason, he also measured in the beer phenyl ethanol and phenyl ethyl acetate. Now, both of those, especially the phenyl ethyl acetate, they smell of roses. And what he showed was a negative, an inverse correlation between the level of phenyl ethanol and phenyl ethyl acetate and the perception of DMS. In other words, the more phenyl ethanol and the more phenyl ethyl acetate, the less was the perception of DMS. And of course, what did he find? He found there was a lot more of these things in Carling Black Label from Burton-on-Trent than there was in Tennent's Lager from Glasgow. In other words, there was less of the masking material. So I went back up to Glasgow and I presented this to them and I got a standing ovation. And I said, and of course, the reason is you're fermenting at the wrong temperature. in which case, on which I was invited to vacate the premises a second time. So again, it illustrates the point I was making. If you want to control these things, you've got to control your fermentation conditions. You can't have two different breweries fermenting at different temperatures, because that will both influence the direct level of DMS production, but also things like phenyl ethanol, phenyl ether acetate, which tend to mask the DMS. So again, this adds to this rich tapestry of variables. And there's just one other as well, Brad, and that is the fact that there are certain bacteria, they love DMSO. So wort spoilage bacteria, things like Obesum bacterium proteus, they really like DMSO, and they will convert 100% of it, all of it, into DMS. Not like the yeast that will convert sort of 10 to 20%, but 100%. So if you've got DMS levels like, I don't know, 250 parts per billion, yeah, I guarantee you've got a wort spoilage bacterium problem. So it's fascinating.
Pretty interesting. Well, Charlie, let's go full circle here. And can you summarize for us how a brewer would want to reduce their DMS overall in a finished beer? What are the different techniques that we discussed?
All right. So the best way to do it is to make sure you've got a malt with a very low SMM level. Mm-hmm. So that means that one that's erring on the side of less well modified and very lightly dried. Higher dried, more drying to break down to get a low SMM level going in. But then you want a vigorous rolling boil. And if you don't want DMS, then err on the side of a longer boil with a vigorous purging of the DMS. Then a short whirlpool stand, and you've got to keep it the same short length every time. So maybe just 10 minutes, 15 minutes. Fermentation at on the higher end of the temperature range for your lager beer, and a good, efficient mixture. The yeast is nice and healthy and so on. And then you should have a low DMS level. For a high DMS level, the opposite.
Well, Charlie, we are coming up at the end of our time, but I wanted to get your closing thoughts on DMS and the whole topic.
Yeah, well, I actually quite like it. When people talk to me about flavor defects, the first molecule that comes into my head is diacetyl. I can't stand diacetyl.
I think you mentioned that before. We did an episode on it.
And there's some fairly famous lagers that have got finite level of diacetyl. So, you know, it's horses for courses. So I like a little bit of DMS in my lager beers. The levels that they know, obviously, that I was quite attached to, something like Carling Black Label. It's just like all of these other things, Brad. You know, you've got to, if you understand the way you want your beer to be, if you understand the flavor profile of your beer, there's no reason why that flavor profile should not have some degree of DMS in it, something in the region of 40, 50 parts per billion. But then you've got to control it. And so it all the time, it comes back that the definition of quality, to my mind, is the same beer every time. So you've got to maintain that. And the way to do it is with good, strong raw material specifications and process specification, standard operating procedures. And then you will get the product you want every time, including your desired level of DMS.
Well, Charlie, always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks again for being here.
Always a pleasure. Keep asking me.
I will. I try and get you on at least once a year. My guest today, Dr. Charlie Bamforth, Professor Emeritus of Malting and Brewing Science at the University of California at Davis. Thanks again, Charlie.
Pleasure.
A big thank you to Charlie Bamforth for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They invite you to join their upcoming brewery workshop, March 24th to 27th in Austin, Texas. This one-of-a-kind event brings together professional brewers to help you start and grow your own craft brewery. To learn more, please visit breweryworkshop.com. Again, that's breweryworkshop.com. And also The Barrel Mill, creator of the Infusion Spiral, used to add flavor and aroma to wine, spirits, and beer. Their unique spiral cut design creates unrivaled surface area in a small package, allowing fast extraction of the toasted oak's aroma and flavor compounds. Looking for woods other than oak? Try their exotic woods. They have spirals made from Amberana, American and French oak, aspen, Spanish cedar, cypress, and sugar maple. For more information, please go to infusionspiral.com. Again, that's infusionspiral.com. And Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith Brewing Software. Beersmith Web lets you design great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with access to the same full suite of recipe building tools as our desktop version. Try Beersmith for the web by creating a free account today at beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder to click those like and subscribe buttons on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're on. Clicking those buttons is a great way to support the show. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.